Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Kevin Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And today we're very pleased to have the coach of the Matildas, Alan Stajic, back on the show with us. Obviously, he brought the team over to Perth and I caught up with him while he was in Perth before they head off for the Asia Cup. And as usual, we will have a couple of topics under discussion that are relevant in the world of sport at the moment. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, do you want to get us started on the topics? Because I know there's one that's just burning a hole.
Well, it's the big topic at the moment, isn't it? It's ball tampering. I got up the other morning and I was shocked when I turned on my television screen to see Cameron Bancroft with his hands in his pockets and allegations of ball tampering. And I thought, this is going to be an interesting story. But it turns out to be the same old, really, doesn't it?
Well,
Except for the reaction.
I did like the mem where he was obviously dropping his little bit of tape down the front of his trousers and someone said, oh, he's just trying to get de cock out.
I did think that
was quite good. Look, I'm with you in that I think that what's happened here are two issues as I see it. One is the ball tampering and then the other is the sort of reaction to Australia being caught ball tampering. Let's be honest.
No, wait a sec. Australia hasn't been caught ball tampering. Members of the Australian
cricket team have been caught ball tampering. But you would think that the whole country had been caught, the way the reaction has been.
You would. You'd think people who'd never played cricket before or even perhaps seen a cricket game have been caught ball tampering.
Yeah, I think, let me deal with one side of that first. I think one of the things is Australians, the way I see it, and I've lived here now for over 30 years, so more than half of my life, the one thing I've found is they like to win, they don't like to lose, they find it hard sometimes to admit when they've lost to a better team, and they will blame a referee, an umpire, or whatever, or the pitch. But the one thing that Australians, and I'm talking the Australian sporting public and the average person that plays, most of them have a very strong sense of fair play. And I think that is where people have got upset, because they've seen other countries cheat, and they felt that we don't cheat. But I think that is a very naive view of the situation in world cricket, because every team does it.
It's been going on for as long as cricket's been played.
Absolutely. You know, it's the most sense I've heard on this whole issue was Simon Dool, the New Zealander. And he was saying, look, we all know ball tampering happens. He goes, what I think they should do is they should allow you to raise the seam with your fingernail. What you can't do is you can't put sawdust or grit in your pocket, because that's bringing something in from outside, an outside influence. He goes, by all means, if you want to rub the ball in the dirt on the wicket, then fine. You can do that because it's actually what's on the pitch. You're using that. He goes, you can't use Vaseline. You can't use sunscreen on the ball. You can't use things that you're bringing into that environment. He goes, but if you're using what's there, that should be okay. But he goes, what I would say is when it gets to 60 overs, new ball. You can't keep the old ball, even if it's swinging brilliantly. It's like, no, compulsory, 60 overs, you get a new ball comes in. And I thought, do you know what, that makes a lot of sense, because I've played in England and over here, and I mean, in the UK you get obviously a lot of dirt between the seam, so you want to pick the dirt out so that when you do hit the seam, the ball will move off the seam. Over here it's a completely different problem, where the wickets are so hard the seam disappears into the ball. So again, you want to pick the seam up so that when it does hit the seam again, you can get a little bit more movement still, and especially spinners want to get that turn and when it grips on the seam. So I think what Simon Dool says is absolutely right. I think he is on the right track, rather than these people who are going, we've got to just ban people for life. That's ridiculous.
I did like Kim Hagdorn's comments. Now, I'm not always Kim's biggest fan, but I liked his comment about what the hell's going on with bowlers letting other people look after the balls for them. It's the bowler's responsibility to look after the ball. Other players have a responsibility for ball maintenance around that, you know, group as you're throwing it back. But it's the bowler's responsibility to look after the ball at the bowling group. What the hell are they letting these other people muck around with the ball for?
Well, I must admit, when I was bowling, I always wanted the ball back in my hands quickly. It would, like, throw it to mid-off, get it back to me, and I'll work on it. Because non-bowlers have no idea. I mean, I remember one guy I played with, he was shining both sides of the ball, and you're just like, what are you doing?
Even in fifth grade, we would talk about what side of the ball we were going to shine. And after the first over, the captain would look at it and go, right, boys, we'll change it, because that's copped a knock in the first, so that this is the side we're going to shine now. Ball maintenance has been around as long as ball tampering has. There's a fine line.
There is indeed. And look, I think, sadly, I think Steve Smith has lost the captaincy. But my point with this is where the person who should be carrying the can, and I'm going to make myself incredibly unpopular probably with what I'm going to say with Cricket Australia, but I would like to know who the media manager was, because he's the one who should be shot for allowing Bancroft and Smith to go into that press conference without a prepared statement. Now, if I was the media manager, we've seen the footage. They would have been probably shown the footage before they walked into that press conference. And I would have had a statement prepared and said, look, it is now in the hands of the match referee.
Yeah.
We're not going to comment until such time as he has done that. But he exposed, the media manager exposed those two players to all the fracas that has come from that. And Smith, sadly, incredibly naive with his comments. He thought, I'll be honest, honesty is the best policy. And it's bitten him in the backside.
Well, what's interesting is they're playing against a team where the opposition captain has been busted for ball tampering twice. Now, when he was charged, what did their board do? It screamed like a stuck pig. It was calling it all sorts of weird and wonderful things. Oh, it wasn't Faf that did anything wrong. It's your conspiracy. It's this. It's that. It's all sorts of stuff, but not the actual issue that was involved. Yet what happens to Steve Smith? He owns up to it and he's pilloried. How are you going to encourage honesty among sports people when you get pilloried for being honest? It's just staggering. And the worst moment in Australian sporting history? Are you kidding me? That's just hyperbole of the most extreme I've ever heard.
Yeah, I don't think it's that bad. I do think that the public feel very let down by what has happened. And to me, I think that the bit, and this is where, again, I blame the media manager, because it was Steve Smith saying in that press conference that we had a meeting of the leadership group, and it then became this premeditated thing. Now, I'm not saying that when you go into, exactly as we said, any other test match where other people have been caught, you can't tell me that the guy who's sucking the mint is not premeditated. Of course it's premeditated. That's why he's sucking the mint. Give me a break.
And don't tell me they didn't talk about it either.
Exactly, but they never disclosed that they talked about it. And I think this is where the issue lies and why everyone's so upset, is this impression that we had Warner, Smith, you would presume Darren Lehman, because he is the coach.
Hazelwood, Stark and Lyon are the other members of that.
Well, okay. They all sat around a table and said, okay, how are we going to do this and how are we going to cheat? And that's the impression that has been put out there. Now, I'm sure it didn't happen like that at all. But I do think Darren Lehman, again, has been sort of very sort of pushed to the side, and makes you wonder, well, if he's not involved in this and had any input, then why do we have a coach? As Shane Warne said, maybe a cricket coach is the one that drives you to the ground every game.
Yeah, well, he's got a point there. What I'm staggered to is by some of the reaction around the world. I mean, I'm glad Michael Atherton hasn't stuck his hand up and said anything about this, but some of the stuff coming out of England, your players admit to tampering with the ball and to winning an Ashes series based on the tampering of the ball. Okay, fine. I'm not getting upset about that, but don't come out then and get on your high horse about it. And as for Indian cricket, mate, next time you're playing at home, count the number of Indian fielders that can't throw a ball 20 metres and it has to bounce into the wicketkeeper. I mean, that's just as bad as someone scuffing the ball up on the dirt, as far as I'm concerned.
But then if you go back to the Simon Dool thing, to me, there's nothing wrong with that. Because, again, as a bowler, if you're throwing it into the ground in a place where it can be difficult to get a shine on the ball, or the ball loses the shine, sometimes that can actually work against you. So you're actually scuffing the ball up monumentally, because you'd have to be pretty damn good to throw a ball and make sure that the side you want scuffed is always going to hit the ground. So, you know, that's where I think Simon Dool has a point. If you wish to do that as a fielding side, go ahead, do it. Mm. But you're stuck with that ball for 60 overs.
It brings into question what exactly is cheating in sport. what is actually gamesmanship and what becomes cheating? I mean, if you want to think about it, me deliberately sticking my foot out to stop a ball go past on a hockey field is as much cheat. That's cheating.
Yeah, it would be regarded as a professional foul, which I hate that term because, you know.
It's cheating.
Yeah, it is cheating. I mean, the worst one for me and something that's killed the game of football is the amount of diving that goes on in that. And you're seeing guys falling in the penalty area that, you know, have clearly not been touched and even post-match, and nothing happens to them. Now, to me, if I was an administrator, I would go, okay, from now on, we're banning any guy that dives for 10 games. You're out for 10 games, because what it'll do is the coach cannot afford to have his striker out for 10 games because he may not get the goals, which could result in the team dropping down the league ladder, which could see him lose his job.
Relegation.
Yeah, it could be relegation. The club's not going to want it, so suddenly they're going to turn around and say, stop diving. The other thing you're going to get from that as well is sponsors will turn around and start saying, hey, hang on a sec, we're giving you all this money. And you know, we're not going to give it to you anymore if you're not playing, which is interestingly, I see a lot of the sponsors are already questioning Warner and Steve Smith. So, you know, it's going to hurt them in their hip pocket because of their, well, Smith's honesty and the fact that the media manager didn't prep him properly for the press conference.
Well, it's the last time you'll ever hear Steve Smith speak straight at a press conference, I would think. He will shut up in future and he'll just toe whatever the line is and give you nothing.
Well, you're going to get that now, John, sadly, from everybody, I think, after this incident, yeah. Because we're going to get more of, oh, well, the crowd were brilliant the way they were behind us, I'm over the moon that we won today, and we're just going to get cliche after cliche after cliche, which we already get in some sports, and it is so damn boring.
Oh, it is. I feel a bit sorry for Steve Smith. Okay, he did the wrong thing, but he didn't kill Bambi. Let's put it in proportion here.
Yeah, look, I think the sanctions handed out by the ICC are in line with what they've done previously. So, you know, he's copped that 100% of his wage, suspended for one game. Bancroft, 75% of his wage, and he gets these demerit points, which I'm not sure I agree with these demerit points. I just sort of think...
Well, it's interesting. If it hadn't been for Smith, this incident, we'd probably be sitting here talking about the absolute abrogation of responsibility the ICC showed when it dumped Jeff Crowe in the mire and knocked back his recommendations and let Rabada play. I mean, that's a shocker in itself. The ICC's got to stick its hand up and start taking control of the game. When you see what goes on in, was it India and Sri Lanka? When you see what goes on in that game and then, you know, Rabada walks away, these players don't get reprimanded for what they did in that particular game. It's just a joke.
But if you remember my last podcast, I was saying Rabada bumping shoulders, give me a break. You know, Smith and they're two of them, they're two grown men. They did it. They didn't square up and punch each other, but it was part of the game. It's like, don't take that, the contest out of the game. That's what people go to see. I want to see that fire in a fast bowler. I don't want to see him going, oh, thank you, I bowled really well, and just walk back meekly to his mark. I want to see him have words with a batsman trying to psych him out. I want to see him intimidate.
Oh, for sure. Well, we love it when Mitchell Starc does it.
Absolutely. I like it when any fast bowler does it, because you want to watch that. Because suddenly you're on the edge of the seat. Is the batsman going to get on top of him? You know, or will the bowler come through? I mean, the classic one was Mitchell Johnson. I mean, the abuse, it wasn't necessarily on the pitch, but the English crowd gave him, and then how he responded was just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in cricket, because it was superb the way he came back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll have to, you know, unfortunately for Steve, he's going to be a middle of cricket. It'll be interesting to see what happens when they do get back.
Well, there might be another book in it for him.
Might be. Who's going to be captain? If he's not going to be, I mean, the opposition's got a captain that's been busted twice for ball tampering, and we're talking about sacking ours? Anyway, should we move on? I think we've had enough to say. But oh, one more thing. What the hell's John Wiley saying anything about it for? Why is John Wiley holding press conferences and talking about the shame of it all for? What's... John, you want to talk about shame? Think about the shame that we felt as sports lovers when the two top sports administrators went toe-to-toe to each other in a verbal stoush in public. Did you get a reprimand for that? Did you stand down for that? And then you... piping up about Steve Smith. Christ, give me a break.
Yeah, I have to say, and then he wanted an investigation into the integrity of Australian sport. It was like...
Well, we can start with your office, mate. How about we start that integrity with your office? How about not using terms like the one from that letter? What was it?
Commercial confidentiality.
Commercial. That's a good one. Yes, you're a taxpayer-funded organisation. The only commercial in confidence you have is with us, the taxpayers, mate.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think it's, yeah, let's move on.
We should. I think I've said enough.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
You are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's time for us to turn our attention to our guest on this podcast. And as you will know, if you live in Perth, Western Australia, we had the Matildas, the Australian women's football team, playing their first ever game against Thailand here in the West. And it was the ideal opportunity to catch up with their coach, Alan Stajic, who we've had on the show before and who I believe has done wonderful things in the 4 years he's been in charge. Alan Stajic, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
How you going? I'm well.
Well, it's good to catch up again because obviously we were talking to you when you were coach of Sydney FC and then just as you became coach of the Matildas, but what a time it's been.
Yeah, it's been an interesting 3 or 4 years now in this role. Had a lot of ups and downs, but look, it's been an enjoyable time and we're riding a good wave at the moment. But, you know, as we know in sport, you just got to keep it going and keep our feet on the ground, which fortunately we have been over the last period of time.
Well, certainly I know everyone in Western Australia is very pleased to see you over here in Perth. It's hard to believe it's the first time the Matildas have ever played here.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that either, actually, when I found out it was the first time. But for us, it just makes logical sense at the moment. We have a tournament in Jordan, so eliminates a little bit of time zone issues on the travel and also a little bit of jet lag. And also we get to spend more time in Australia spreading the wings of our teams, but also, you know, having the creature comforts of being in an Australian port rather than preparing overseas, which can sometimes be a bit challenging. So everything pointed to a good prep here in Perth, and it's turned out to be that way. The hospitality we've had here has been fantastic. The support from the WA government, the Western Australian Football Organisation has been fantastic, and hopefully we get a good crowd in against Thailand on Monday.
Have you trained on NIB yet or not?
Yeah, we did one session there last night. It's in really good nick. So, yeah, it's pleased to go to a football stadium for starters. And, look, hopefully we get a good crowd at such a boutique venue. And, you know, if we can get 10 or 15,000 there, I think it'll be a good experience for our team and also another boost to the profile of women's football in this country.
I must admit, I think it is one of the best surfaces to play on in the country and that the groundsman deserves a real pat on the back.
Yeah, it is. But again, it goes back to the adage, it's a football ground. You know, it's not shared amongst too many sports too often. You know, I know there's a little bit of rugby there at times, but just to have a boutique venue that's designed for football codes is sensational. We don't have enough of those in Australia.
No, we don't. Before we talk about the Asia Cup, I mean, I want to go back because it seems to me from the outside looking in that the Olympics and the performance there in Rio was really what captured the non-football public's imagination. That was what really elevated the Matildas. Did you feel that?
I've actually said that to everyone over the last couple of months. I think that's what catapulted the team into the non-sort of football public's spotlight, I guess. I think that penalty shootout match that we had against Brazil was on at a time where everyone was watching. You know, I came home and I've had hundreds of people who came up to me and said they were watching that game and watched the shootout. They were walking through a shopping centre and were watching the game, or they had it on the radio, or they were playing cricket or football at the time and had to stop and watch the shootout. So there were so many non-football people who were attracted to the team. And then the year after, when we had a lot of success, I think a lot of the foundation work was built up on that performance and that game the year before.
How difficult was it, though, to pick the team up after that? Or was it a case that they realised they were so close that all it needed was a little bit maybe more hard work and they could go a bit further?
Yeah, look, I think it was quite easy to be picked up from that. I think the motivation was stronger. I felt that the team thought it was a missed opportunity by us to win a medal at a major tournament for the first time in history. So when you have that hunger and desire, and it almost fuels the fire even more to work harder and know that you're so close, but if you do actually do the extra few yards and do everything that little bit better, that we really can be a contender on the world stage. And I think it elevated the motivation, but also the belief within the group that we can be a good team on the world stage and one that can compete with the best countries in the world.
As a coach, do you look back on that or do you just look forward now?
I'd like to say I only look forward, but I always look back and reflect on the moments we've had as a team, good and bad, and look at the things that we've done well that have worked, and look at the things that we haven't done well that we can do better. So, I'm a bit of a reflector, so I always look back, and sometimes it hurts to look back on games like that, or the whole tournament, in fact. But, look, so many lessons were learnt during that tournament that we've corrected or tried to improve, and hopefully that'll keep the team and our performances improving over the next period of time. And I think we've seen that, over the last 12 or 14 months.
No, I think we've seen it over the last 4 years. If we look back now to how you took over leading into the Asia Cup in 2014, and you were a very late appointment, and you had to really pull together a team that was not a happy team at the time, but you still managed to get them to gel and perform.
Yeah, look, I'd like to take all the credit for that, but as we know, look, within a team there's so many dynamics and so many factors that all come together at the one point in time, and, I'm a coach, but there's so many support staff, all the players and everyone's piece in that jigsaw puzzle is important. So, look, I think we've all grown together as a group over that period of time, 3 or 4 years that we've been together now. I think I've got one of the best support staffs in any team across our country, from the medical to the administrative support to the coaching support, I think is first class. The players have really grown and developed and matured over the last 3 or 4 years in their own individual right, and the amount of depth that we've developed within the team is also becoming a strength, whereas I think it was possibly a weakness in the team, in the previous few years before that. So, look, a lot of things are coming together, but from my perspective now, it's about being humble, having that humility to know where you're at and know what you need to do to keep growing and keep improving, because, football's such a massive sport around the world, and if we stand still in football, we'll be going backwards very quickly, and it's important that we keep improving and keep looking at all the areas that we can do better so that we do stay where we are, or even keep edging higher up in the world. We've been in the top 5 or 6 now in the world for over a couple of years now, so I think we've shown that we're a consistent team at that level, but look, our goal is to get in the top 3, and we haven't achieved that yet, so still plenty of work to do.
You mentioned that support, and it does feel from the outside, again, looking in, that the FFA are beginning to give the women's game a little bit more support. And the W League, I think, has certainly helped, and the standard looks to have gone up as well with the sort of cross-pollination of the women going, our players going to America and the American players coming here.
Yeah, for sure. I think the league's grown. The amount of internationals and the variance of countries they come from is amazing, really, now. From where the league started 10 years ago, where we didn't have one, to now at least 3 or 4, even 5 in each team is amazing. And the quality of those players coming in is fantastic. They're all internationals. We've had, just off the top of my head, 2 or 3 Americans who came in as just league players and have gone back to their own league and become US national team players in the next 6 to 12 months. So they're obviously seeing a lot of value in coming to the league. I spoke to one of the Norwegian girls who came out this year at Algarve, and she just couldn't believe how hard the matches actually were, the intensity of the matches, how hard it was to play in the summer and in the heat. So, look, I know that the international players think it's a good comp. They think it's difficult. They think it helps their development, and it's obviously enjoyable coming to Australia as well. So, they're getting a lot of benefit from it, but the flow-on effects for our players and our comp is amazing. To have young players who now have Matildas to look up to, internationals who come in to look up to, challenge them at training, to learn from at training, is only going to grow our game into the future. So the more the W League evolves in that respect, the better it will be. And when you look at all the aspects of W League, when you look at the CBA that's been signed, now there's actual support in terms of financial support for the players, so possibly the players can play even longer now. They don't have to retire at 25 or 26, which was probably the trend, over the last 15, 20 years of women's football. And hopefully we reverse that trend, and that will increase the depth even more. So we'll have good kids coming through, better learning environment for the kids coming through, but hopefully more players staying into their late 20s and early 30s and then being able to pass on that knowledge and experience on the next generation.
That learning environment, I would think, when you come to pick those younger players to regenerate the team, makes it a lot easier because they're not as overawed when they get into the national setup.
Nah, for sure. And we've just started a Future Matildas program in the last week as well, which is now another buffer and another level of national team performance, which is a centralised program in Sydney for our best 15 to 20-year-olds. So during non-W League time, we've now got an extra layer of support for those players to hopefully decrease the gap from youth national teams to the Matildas.
Now, you're heading off to the Asia Cup. As I say, last 4 years ago, a lot of people didn't give you a chance, but you got to the final. A little bit unfortunate to lose that one if we put our biased head on and parochial, but you've got a very tough group this time.
Yeah, look, the draw wasn't favourable for us, that's been consistent throughout the last 3 or 4 years, that we've always had tough draws, looking back at the World Cup and the Olympic Games as well. But look, for sure, it's a tough group. We don't underestimate anyone. Korea is a fantastic team. Two or three of the best midfielders in the world. They've got G, who plays at Chelsea and is probably the best player at Chelsea. He's their number 10. So, look, a fantastic team. Japan's in our group, you know, been in the top three or four in the world for the last 7 or 8 years now. They've dropped away in the rankings a little bit, but I certainly don't underestimate their quality. They're a fantastic team, and they can beat anyone on any given day. So we're going to have our work cut out for us in the Asian Cup just to get through our group and be in the top two in the group. But look, I know if we play to our potential now that I think we're the favourites going into each match, and if we play to our potential, we'll win. And I don't think we've been in that boat before. You know, I don't think we've been in the boat where we know if we play to our best, we'll win. You know, we were always the underdog previously. We always had to outperform even our own ability just to get a result, whereas, you know, there's a level of confidence and belief and maturity in this team that now knows that we need to keep a consistent level, and if we keep to that level, then we'll be the dominant team on the day.
Vietnam is the other team in your group, and we've seen a huge improvement in their men's program. What are they like in the women? Could they cause an upset to one of your sort of opposition teams?
Yeah, look, definitely. I don't underestimate them or Thailand. I think they're probably the two, and Jordan, in fact, the three emerging Asian teams, but from Southeast Asia, certainly Vietnam have put a lot of money into their football program. Their women's team have been centralised for a long time, getting a lot of matches under their belt, and in the same respect, Thailand have as well. So, you know, looking back to our Olympic Games qualifiers, you know, we beat Vietnam 9-0 in that match, which was just over a year and a half ago now, possibly 2 years ago. But every other game was within a goal or two. North Korea, who were ranked 7 in the world, beat them in the 92nd minute 1-0. And I think China beat them 2-1 or 2-0. So all the rest of their matches were very close. It was really only our game that was a blowout. So, you know, I certainly don't underestimate Vietnam's and Thailand's and countries like that. And they've certainly improved over the last 2 or 3 years. And the amount of investment and resources they're putting towards their men's and women's football, as we saw, the men's team won the under-23s just recently, you know, just shows the level of interest and care that their federations are putting into their football programs, which means that we're just going to have more competition, which is excellent for Southeast Asia and football in general.
Absolutely, because it raises the standard overall and means you've got to be better to get to the top.
Yeah, for sure. Look, it's happening around the world. Women's football especially is growing exponentially around the world. You know, we know men's football's been established for such a long time, but, you know, we recently went to Algarve, and to think how much Portugal's improved over the last few years, yet they're ranked in the low 30s. I've seen countries like Belgium and Switzerland and Italy and Spain, who have traditionally not been strong, Austria, Colombia, some African countries as well, who are improving. Look, it's really going to be a competitive sphere over the next 5 to 10 years, and you know, as I alluded to a bit earlier on, if we don't stay on top of our game now, we'll fall behind the pack. We've really got to ensure we do everything right in Australia to keep us in the top 5 or 6 in terms of competitiveness and rankings, because the world really is investing a lot in women's football in terms of the pathways, in terms of club structures. You know, Atletico Madrid and Barcelona are now full-time, and you can imagine the amount of investment that clubs like that can put into their programs. Juventus have just started a women's team. Manchester United are looking to start a women's team for the first time. Manchester City are spending millions on their women's team. So when you think about the big clubs that are now starting to invest in women's football, we've really got to do everything right in Australia to ensure that we stay, you know, where we're at the top echelon of teams. Otherwise, you know, we'll fall behind, and it'll be very, very hard for us to keep up in the future.
Just finally, Alan, because we talked about the fact that now the Matildas are on the map, people are embracing, but with that comes expectation, because obviously, again, there are some people in Australia who don't understand that the landscape of the football that you've just talked about and the investment that other countries make, but is there now the pressure of expectation to achieve?
Oh, look, there probably is a little bit of that, but for me, you know, I can't talk for every player individually, but for me personally, my own expectations is still higher than what the public's is. So if we lose or don't play well, and we get criticism for it publicly, you know, it doesn't affect me because I know that my own internal criticism will probably be greater than what we get from the outside, because we've set high expectations for our team. We want to be a top three team, and, you know, that's really easy to say. We want to be a top three team in the world or compete for medals, but, you know, the reality is it's actually unbelievably difficult in football, you know, to compete with the likes of Germany or USA or France or an England, a Holland, you know, Norway, Sweden. These countries have been so good in women's football and football for such a long time. For a little country with all the, you know, lack of resources that we have in Australia, it's unbelievably difficult. You know, this team is severely punching above its weight in terms of what we've got at our disposal. The difficulty we have in travelling, in getting international matches, the expense that it is for us to travel as opposed to other countries who can just jump on a bus and play internationals. You know, a lot of other countries have an under-17s team, an under-18s team, an under-19s. You know, we just can't afford to have all those things because Australia is so big and we're so far away from the rest of the world. So there's a lot of disadvantages we have. So we have to make sure we do everything smart, we do everything right. At the moment, we're doing a lot of things well. But there's always room for improvement, and there's always things we need to do better to really challenge for that top three and try and get a medal in football, because the football world is just so competitive. You know, you're looking at a country like America of 280 million people. I think they've got 20 million girls who play football. They've got over 1,000 colleges who support semi-professional environments. You know, those numbers are just staggering, and we're competing with them. And we beat them last year for the first time in history. But for us to compete with them over a long period of time, we've got to do everything we can, you know, as efficiently, as effectively as we can.
Well, Alan, great to catch up again. We wish you all the best, and we've really enjoyed the journey you've been on.
Thanks, Ash.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And that was Alan Stajic, the coach of the Matildas, who, as I mentioned, I think he's done a great job. They've got a really tough group, John, in the Asia Cup with Japan, South Korea and Vietnam. Vietnam is a country, as he said in that interview, is really on the rise. They've put a lot of money into their football program. And I wouldn't be surprised if they might surprise one of those two teams with just get a draw or something like that. But Japan, a little bit on the wane at the moment. But as he says, he sees South Korea as the danger team. But he believes that the Matildas are the best team in that group and they should get out of the group. And let's hope that is the case.
Well, they're making the running for the world game in this country, aren't they?
Oh, look, they are. And, I mean, they played very well against Thailand. They, you know, got a 5-0 victory. It was disappointing, the crowd. I was a little bit disappointed. And this is probably going to be my topic, to be honest, on this, is to talk about the football side of things and the Matildas and a few of the things I think the FFA maybe got wrong. One was having a 6 o'clock kickoff on a Monday night. And I spoke to a few people who got there late and they said it was just so hard to get to NIB Stadium. And the fact that there's no parking around there made it equally hard. I know that they were looking to get around 14,000. They ended up with 7 and a bit, and they gave 4,000 tickets away, I believe. Now, we don't know how many of those 4,000 turned up, but it was just disappointing. The first time the Matildas are here, people in Western Australia, and you say it with your hockey, they moan that we don't get games, but then when we get them, they don't go and support them. Now, if you want to see the best teams playing here, you've got to get off your backside and go and watch the game.
Especially considering that one of the star players for the team is a local girl who's had plenty of press.
Well, I mean, look, Lisa Devana, I mean, I got a bit upset because, you know, okay, Sam Kerr's stealing the headlines. She's possibly one of the best players in the world at the moment. But Lisa Devana consistently has been one of the best players in the world, and she is also in a very rare situation. Like, everyone raves about Tim Cahill scoring 3 goals in 3 World Cup finals. Lisa Devana's done it, and I can tell you there's less women have managed to achieve that than there are men. So Lisa Devana, in my opinion, should be at least up in the Tim Cahill rankings as a player and how she's rated.
Is Lisa Devana the Mark Viduka of the Matildas?
I think you're probably right. I think she probably is. I certainly think she's very misunderstood, as Viduka was misunderstood.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, her position and the way she plays in the team, I mean, she's not necessarily the one that's going to score the flashy goals, but she's the workhorse that
Yeah, look, they've got several workhorses. I mean, she scored two goals in that game. She should have probably ended up with four or five. You know, she ballooned one over the bar, which she couldn't believe. She had another volley that went wide, which normally she would have put that on target. But, I mean, she's one of the hardest players on herself you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
So she'll be thinking about those.
She's hard on the opponents too, just quite.
Absolutely. But you mentioned Sam Kerr. This was a really interesting one because, you know, you were sat there and most of the people were in the new stand at NRB Stadium, which obviously made it look good on television. Now, a lot of people were clearly there just to see Sam Kerr.
Yeah.
Now, Alan Stajic substituted a starter into the second half, probably 10 minutes into the second half. And a lot of people were upset about that, saying, well, she should have played the whole game because we were there to watch her. Hang on a second. This guy is preparing for an international tournament, a tournament that will see them qualify, if they win it, directly into the Women's World Cup. And you just think, no, he is preparing for a major tournament. This was a friendly. He wanted a game to give the girls game time. He is doing what is best for them in this tournament. And I thought that showed, again, a real naivety in the footballing public here. But to be fair, a lot of those people that were going were not proper footballing fans. It was brilliant to see so many young children there. I don't think I've ever been to NRB Stadium and seen so many people, I would say, under the age of 16 at a football match. Since the early days of the glory.
Oh, wow.
But here again is where the FFA, and I hate to continually have a go at these people, but you just think, get the basics right. So I've just said to you there, all these people were there because Sam Kerr, a lot of them you don't really see at football normally, and you could tell they were new fans. So why was there not a program? I mean, there were people sitting next to me, didn't even know who Sam Kerr was. They go, she's the number 20. That's all they knew. So she'd already gone off the pitch, and they were looking for her, but they couldn't see her. So again, if you have a program, you can at least refer to that. Also, this was an historic game, the first time the Matildas have ever played. Now, people that are fans of the game, like myself, I wanted a program to record that event to keep it, because it was a special moment in the game's history, and the FFA didn't produce one. And I just shake my head and think, what are you doing? You're talking about promoting the game, and you don't do something as simple as that.
A program, especially when you're playing against a foreign team like Thailand. Like, what's the chances of knowing who anybody is on the Thai team? And just, I agree with you, programs are a must at events like that.
Look, and it doesn't have to be 25 pages of colour. It doesn't have to be that. You can do it much simpler. You could do even like a one-page sheet with both teams and a word from the coaches on the other side or whatever. I'm not asking for, you know, gold embossed, leather bound, you know. It just needed
bit
something.
Bit of photocopying.
Yeah, but also, you know, a lot of people there didn't know other players apart from Lisa Devana and Sam Kerr. Yeah. They didn't know any of the other Matildas. I mean, Lydia Williams, obviously in goal, again, another WA girl. But did we see anything? Who would have known she was another WA girl?
Yeah. It's interesting because I wonder, the people who had the reaction about, you know, why did you take Sam Kerr off, I wonder how they would have felt if she had done a knee in the 50th minute.
Yeah.
You know, would they then be saying, oh, why did you leave her on the field? You're a friendly. It's a friendly. What's the score when she goes off? 3-0?
Yeah, it was 3 or 4-0, yeah.
Why, if any other sport, you're taking your star player off and you're putting them on the bench, aren't you?
Yeah, of course you are.
In a friendly.
For a major tournament.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that, again, yeah, I, as I say, I don't like criticising constantly the FFA, but I just think they have people in there that don't think, or they don't know, or they're incredibly arrogant that they don't look at other sports as to how they do things and go, oh, that would be a better way of doing this. Here's an example. So Claire Polkinghorn, playing in the defence, she played apparently that was her 102nd game, but there was an award given to her post-game for her 100th cap. So you're going, well, hang on a second. According to your press release, that was her 102nd game for the Matildas, and you're presenting her with something for her 100th today. But they did it after the game. So people are flooding out of the ground.
Yeah.
And here is someone's special moment. 100 caps for your country. Massive achievement. Huge achievement. Surely you would want the public there to acknowledge, to give you a round of applause. But to do it after the game was ludicrous. Now, the sport you love, and I commentate a lot, hockey, the one thing they do is before the national anthems, if there's a milestone, they do it brilliantly. They go, "We'll please acknowledge today."
One of the few things they do brilliantly, but go on,
John. They do. No, that's not fair. But they do it superbly because they go, "Let's acknowledge so and so playing his 100th game today," and the player steps out of the line to take the applause. And
gets
usually,
a bouquet.
Yeah, and usually the coach will come forward, present them with a bouquet or a momentum. They acknowledge the crowd. They give it back to the coach. It goes onto the bench. They then join the lineup again, and we go into the national anthems. Simple. But everybody then acknowledges that player. Yeah. Everybody knows who that player is on the day that has reached that milestone. And it's what they deserve. And let's not forget, it's what the players deserve. We should be doing it for them because they're who we go and watch.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. And they do that very well, honouring those sort of caps.
They do, you know. I mean, we criticise other sports, but hockey does that particularly well. If you look at rugby, they have that player run out first.
Yeah.
You know, again, there are different ways of doing it, but I just think to do it post-match as everybody's leaving the ground, if I was the player, I'd be insulted by the people governing my game. I would think, you really don't care what I've achieved.
No. Well, you'd certainly feel that way, wouldn't you? And the disappearing crowd, would because you'd be standing there and you'd be watching them leave, you know, as you stand there.
That's just sad. I just find it very, very sad, you know?
Yeah. It is, especially for the player concerned who's put so much effort and time into getting to that position.
Now, just one last thing, John. I don't know if you've heard, as we're recording this, there's been a story come out that Julie Bishop is saying, with the whole problems with Russia, that they may withdraw the Socceroos from the World Cup. Now, again, touching on the sport you love, we've seen the hurt that caused when they withdrew the athletes from the 1980 Moscow Olympic Games. I think it's a very dangerous path the government are going down if they're going to withdraw the Socceroos. I also think it would be a massive mistake because I don't think they're going to qualify for the next World Cup with the squad of players they have at the moment and the talent coming through. So this could be our first World Cup, our last World Cup for possibly 8 years, maybe longer. But the guys have earned the right to go. It should, to me, it should come down to their decision if they want to play or not.
Well, that would be making people run amok down the corridors of the FFA. That's the one. There's too many acronyms. Yeah, the FFA corridors. I mean, that's their cash cow. And you take that cash cow away, Julie, who's going to stump up the money? Where's that coming
probably
from?
Probably Mr. Lowy will go cup in hand again to the government.
Yeah, and another $40 million will go down the tube. Why do politicians always want to stick their neck in? Hey, Julie, if you want to make a difference, how about some economic sanctions? Why is it always sportsmen that have to carry this can for other people's morality? Because that's what it is. It's Julie Bishop trying to play the morality card, and we're holier than thou, and we're going to make the sports people pay for it.
I would say the reason they do that, John, is because that's visible. Trade sanctions, you and I... We don't see that.
It's easy to knock back a sportsman and just say, well, you know, it's for the moral good. But when there's money to be made, it's a different story.
Yeah, look, I remember during the Falklands War in England, you know, trade ceased with Argentina. But then Argentinian beef was being shipped from Argentina to Spain and coming into the UK from Spain, but just relabeled. So we were still getting Argentinian beef. So these trade sanctions are a crock.
Yeah, essentially.
A lot of them. But I just think it would be very, very sad for that to happen. But we mentioned about, you know, Mr. Lowy going cup in hand again to the government. If you really want a good read and if you want to be absolutely stunned. Now, I knew quite a bit about the World Cup bid, but reading Benita Merciardi's book, Whatever It Takes, my opinion of Mr. Lowy, which was never very high, has sunk even lower. And my opinion of Ben Buckley, which was, again, very low to start with, it's in the negative rankings now.
Fair enough. Speaking of negative rankings, just before we go, went to the new Perth Stadium the other day, had my first experience there. Lovely stadium, it's what you'd expect a stadium to be. Food's just as rubbish though.
So it wouldn't pass the Darren Harper burger test?
Does it? No toasted cheesies either. I couldn't find a toasted cheesy, so it doesn't pass the toasted cheesy test. It was pretty average. If they had sold it as just being, look, it's just going to be stadium food, I wouldn't have said a word. But they sold it as being something else, and it's not that thing at all.
Well, I just mentioned Darren Harper, who was one of the first co-hosts on Not the Footy Show. But he knew a good burger when he had one, and he always reckoned that the Perth Heat burgers at Barbagallo Park were the best in the sporting landscape in Perth.
Well, we'll have to get out there again one night and try and see if they're still upholding the standard.
And whether they still have his little plaque there.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.